Hey there, dudes and dudettes, and welcome to Tubular Time Machine, the podcast that cranks the nostalgia dial all the way to 11. I'm your host, Jason Raz Rasmussen, and each week we jump into our gnarly retro ride and rocket back to a specific year between 1971 and 2000, reliving the raddest music, movies, TV shows, video games, toys, slang, and pop culture moments that make growing up in the United States so totally bodacious. But I'm not flying solo. Every episode features a special co-host who is exactly 14 years old that year, ready to dish on everything from mixtapes and mall food courts to butterfly clips and blowing into NES cartridges like a wizard. So grab your slap bracelet, rewind your cassette, and fire up the Tubular Time Machine theme song, where the past is always rad and the vibes never go out of style. Fire up your Walkman, rewind your VHS, and hop into the flannel-lined wormhole. We're headed straight back to 1995. Today, we're thrilled to welcome a very special guest to the show. He was once my star pupil, sharp, curious, and always asking the kind of questions that made the rest of the class lean in. But Jeremy Craig didn't stop there. No, he took that passion for the past and ran with it, across the pond, no less. Jeremy went on to study history at university in the United Kingdom, where he managed to surpass even my knowledge of the subject. Not that I'm bitter. Okay, maybe a little. But here's a little twist. In 1995, Jeremy wasn't just any teenager. At the age of 14, he was already cultivating a totally unique and bohemian view of the world, equal parts mixtape philosopher and flannel-clad culture critic. He was living in the 90s from the inside out, soaking in every trend, newsflash, and pop culture pulse like it was liquid gold. So buckle up, listeners. Today we're diving into the year 1995 with someone who lived it, studied it, and can now help us understand it better than ever. Please welcome my former student, now fellow historian and full-time time traveler, Jeremy Craig.
Thank you. That's that was quite an introduction. I don't know if I deserve it all, but thank you.
I think it might be better than just saying, yeah, I used to be one of my students.
Yeah, no, understandable. It's funny. I was probably not the typical 14-year-old in 1995 for a couple of reasons. One, my parents were like very religious and strict. And so I was, a lot of the more adult-oriented things were out of my view unless my whatever hood rat friends would introduce it to me. And my dad was one of the cheapest men on the planet, but he had this weird thing where he thought it was vitally important for me and my brother to have access to the latest like computer technology that was available. So when I was 4 years old, he bought a Commodore 64. So I had been using a computer since like before I could read and write proficiently. And we got access to the internet in like 1993, I think, before search engines even existed. So it was not a typical experience, I guess, for most kids that age. It was wild.
Yeah, I think those back in those days were the BBSs, the bulletin board systems.
Yeah, yeah. And if you wanted to go to a website, you had to know the URL or the, what is the numerical, like the 168.19
IP address.
Yes, you had to either have the URL or the IP address of the website you wanted to go to, and you had to type it in exactly. And if you didn't type it in exactly, you just didn't get to the website.
Either that or you get sucked off the dark web.
Right. Yeah, or to something you really didn't want to see.
Why am I suddenly at a Chinese restaurant?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, great. Yeah. So this is interesting because this is now the fifth podcast I've done. And out of five of the podcasts, five of my guests have had this religious upbringing to where they got limited on their viewing or their ability to access pop culture at the time. So interesting that this is a repeating theme.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not that we were cut off from pop culture completely. Like my brother and I, our grandmother had gotten us a Nintendo when we were younger, and by this point we had a Sega Genesis, and we were allowed to consume pop culture. It just couldn't be overtly violent or have sexual content or whatever, you know, stuff like that.
Understood. So you were not watching The Usual Suspects in 1995 as a 14-year-old?
I was not. No, I did see Toy Story.
So does the violence of Buzz Lightyear on Woody, you know, the slapping themselves in the face, that was okay.
or Sid upon the toys. I was allowed to watch Jurassic Park when I was like 12, which is my uncle convinced my parents to let me go watch that. So, you know, it's not, again, it wasn't like a hard line. It was just, there was a vaguely developed wall against certain types of content, I guess.
Speaking of that, then, why don't we just go ahead and jump into movies at the time, 1995. You already mentioned Toy Story. I mean, this is the biggest, newest thing in an age where computer animation was still coming into fruition at very early stages. And having a film that was 100% CGI, a full-length film, was mind-blowing.
And it was. I sincerely, like, I think people who were born later are used to this as a normal thing. Many movies and TV shows are purely computer generated images, but this was mind blowing. And there were, I believe there were like predecessors to this, which were short films, but it was so well done, so well animated. It is the thing which put Pixar on the map and brought them out of obscurity. The short films they had done before were not widely known. And it's funny, watching this in 1995 was mind-blowing. Watching it now, it looks quite bad. It looks quite like all the textures are a little bit too smooth and the animations are slightly clunky, but they didn't seem that way in 1995. They seemed like sharp and perfect, like this incredible innovation, I guess.
Well, I think I remember seeing an interview with Lasseter somewhere, John Lasseter, talking about the sheer computing power and that Disney actually wasn't really behind the idea of computer animation. Yeah. Thought it was a gimmick, a fad kind of thing. And they said, this will never work. And then we kind of see where that went from there.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mentioned The Usual Suspects, because for like a long time, Jurassic Park was my favorite movie. And then I saw The Usual Suspects in, I think it had to be like 1998 or 1999. So a few years later at a friend's house. And that became my favorite movie for a while. But I did not see it in 1995.
Yeah, a 14-year-old seeing that one would be, yeah, even for non-religious families, would probably be that one. The Usual Suspects to me, that's one of those ones. My son now is 13, and I really want to show him these films that have the twists, you know, the ones that you can't get away from once you hear them. I tried showing him Soylent Green, and he didn't like that because of the dystopian future. He doesn't like the idea of dystopian futures. I'd love to show him Usual Suspects. I want to show him Sixth Sense, but I don't think he's got the fortitude to get through that yet in things. So there are certain ones that's like, I got to get to them before he hears what the twist is. And Usual Suspects, of course, being one of those. Toy Story, you remember, I assume, pretty fondly, at least.
I do, yeah. It was... Yeah, like I said, it was great. And I was still, like, 14 is a weird age because you're not quite an adult. You're not quite a child anymore, but you're still kind of walking that line. And so I think there was enough in Toy Story to make it entertaining to adults. And so obviously for adolescents at that age as well. But I, like, you know, it's funny, Babe is also on this list, and that was another movie that was kind of on that line as well, something that was entertaining to older individuals, but also kids as well.
Yeah, I had to show my son Babe's a classic. Babe's a great one.
It is. And speaking of religious content, Touched by an Angel is on this list. Oh, that was huge in our household. We watched that as a family, whatever night it came out. I can't remember now.
Let's see. What else did you think you saw? There's actually some pretty good ones for 14-year-olds old in 1995.
Yeah, I did see Batman Forever, which even at the age of 14, I was like, this is not very good.
no Tim Burton.
No Tim Burton. We watched as a family Apollo 13. That's another like absolute classic. Nice like level of intensity. And
actually, this week in school, I was just finishing up my material and we got to the space race. And so Apollo 13 was one of the topics there, but also during COVID, obviously everybody was locked down, but my friend in Florida, he's down there near Kennedy Space Center. They had a streaming, thing with one of the astronauts. I can't remember which one, from Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And so my son got to ask him a question and things. So that was pretty cool. Asked if the damage that he saw from the capsule on the ship was as bad as it seemed in the movie. And he's like, oh yeah, it was pretty bad. Apollo 13 as a 14-year-old, that would be a pretty awesome, intense movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Another one of my favorite movies of all time is on this list as well, which is Braveheart. Mm-hmm. I, again, didn't see that one then. I think the first time I saw that was either 97 or 98. I was still, it was over at like a party at somebody's house and they had it on and I was like, wow, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Party. Woo, Braveheart.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Freedom. Taking shots every time he says freedom. And
you know, say what you will about Mel Gibson as a man, he's pretty good at telling a story.
It's difficult for me to watch Mel Gibson films these days.
Oh, he is pretty awful as a human being. But
let's see here, you had another couple of teenage ones that would have been good. Jumanji and Casper.
Yep, I saw both of those. Neither one of those were like, I think kids who were like slightly younger in 95 really like latched onto Jumanji as like a cultural touchstone. But I think it was like just slightly too young for me to really love it. Yeah. It's same with Pocahontas. I was like, oh, Disney movies. I'm too old for Disney movies. You know, that kind of a thing. Casper, I enjoyed, but I think kind of the same thing. I was like, this is too much of a kid's movie, I think, for me. I am outgrowing these.
Too cool for school.
Yeah, I guess so. Something like that.
Casper, back then, I still liked Christina Ricci from the Adams family and stuff. So Casper, I enjoyed that film as well.
She's making a resurgence now. She's been in a lot of in Yellow Jackets especially, but I've seen her in a bunch of movies recently as well.
Yeah, she was in Wednesday as well. So yeah, it's good to see her back. You know, she's always been a fun actress. I've enjoyed her over the years and things.
Same.
So you were not going to see Seven in the theater as a 14-year-old.
No, no, no. Again, that's another one that I came to enjoy later. Like, you know, when I was about 18 or 19, I think I saw that for the first time.
Do you have any other movies that aren't on my list that you remember fondly from the time frame?
To be honest, I had forgotten that most of these movies came out in 1995. I guess given the fact that it has been now 20 years since this time, oh my God, 30 years. It's been 30 years since this time. I all of this left my brain and I had to be reminded based on the list that you sent, but no, I think that pretty well does it.
Yeah. That's how it is with a lot of folks here. They're like, oh, that came out that year.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like we typically associate, we go, oh, 14 was the year this film came out. It's more like when I was a teenager, this film came out.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of a general vague sense that somewhere in this general pocket of time is when that movie came out.
Moving on then, how about television shows? You already mentioned Touched by an Angel. That one sounds like, it was important or a big one for you. What about that show? Was it just a family event or was it something that you really enjoyed?
I remember sort of vaguely enjoying it. I don't remember any of the specific episodes, so it must not have been that memorable. Because it was family friendly and sort of vaguely religious, Christian to be specific, that was right up the, you know, it was like Highway to Heaven and Little House on the Prairie and shows like that were part of my younger childhood. And so this was kind of a continuation of that, where like the whole family would sit down together and watch this show. I remember it being okay. I remember, I don't know if it's because I got older that the show got worse, or if it just got worse over time, because that's how a lot of TV shows are. It starts off sort of stronger and then over time, the premise starts to wear thin.
Yeah, I would guess a little of both probably, because you get out of that younger stage, you don't want to spend as much time with your family and stuff. You know, not, I shouldn't say it's spend time with the family, but spending time in front of the TV with the fam, that kind of thing. Probably a little of both.
And the same with like Full House. We watch Full House as a family because that was part of the, what do they call it? The Friday night block of...
You know, this is the funny thing, is this is the second time it's come up on our podcast and I can't remember the Friday night themed.
I can remember the theme song. It was like, it's Friday night and the moon is bright. Got to have some fun showing TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. That's what it was. TGIF. Dude. My God.
Thank you
for that song. That song jogged my memory. But yeah, so that was like Family Matters was on that. Step by Step, I think, was on that for a while. Yeah, but anyway, it was Full House and Family Matters were like the two shows that we watched on that kind of religiously. Both.
No pun intended. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, religiously. It was funny to sort of like over time have it revealed that Bob Saget was such a like weird, crass comedian because he was such a wholesome family man on this show.
I think he kind of did that, his comedy, his stand-up specifically to balance out his dad image from the show.
He had to show off, yeah, pretty much.
Oh, when he passed a few years ago, it was interesting. I knew he was popular. I knew he had friends and stuff, but a lot of the comedians that came and talked about him or talked about his passing and things just said how great of a guy he was and everything.
Yeah, and that's the impression, that I got out of it, is that all sort of various images that he took on, various personas for various things, but that he was in general a pretty great guy, yeah.
I was a Full House fan back then, and it was fun to see the reboot that they did on Netflix recently. It was kind of, it was still cheese whiz, but it was fun to see the girls grown up and all of that, and kind of still that cheesy Friday night canned sitcom pattern, of all the sitcoms of the day.
Yeah, I guess like Home Improvement was another one that we watched pretty regularly. Yeah, a lot of these we didn't, I was too young for stuff like ER and Seinfeld and Friends and Frasier. That was all sort of stuff that didn't really appeal to me. You know, some of the younger stuff obviously did. I wasn't allowed to watch Xena Warrior Princess because it was all like magic and sorcery and stuff like that. But
that's a shame. That was I watched that one like crazy back then. That was one of the ones that one of the first TV shows I think that actually had a lesbian relationship, but they didn't like say it was a lesbian relationship pretty much.
Yeah. But so my very first girlfriend when I was 16 years old, that was her favorite TV show. So I watched quite a lot of it when I was 16.
I guess the girlfriends will draw you in. Being away from the house and having the luxury of watching something that you're not supposed to watch, maybe that was a little feeling as well.
Yeah, around this time would have been when I would go over to my friend Mike's house because Mike's parents would let him watch anything. And so I saw all manner of things that I probably shouldn't have. Like there was I can't remember if it was 94 or 95, but he had a VHS copy of the horror version of Phantom of the Opera. So lots of like sort of slasher, like insane fake blood flying everywhere kind of movie.
I find that interesting too, because I think this is the second or third podcast that we've talked about that going over to the friend's house that has the VHS or the friend's house that has things that you're not allowed to watch and watching it over there. So yeah, this is a repeated theme, but definitely one of the 14-year-old. Oh yeah, this is the good stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was eye-opening for a child who had never seen such a thing.
It scarred you for life, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Now you go see the Broadway show and you're like, oh my God, no, okay, no, I'm fine. This is an interesting year for premieres, though. They had a lot of premieres of shows that are still some of the ones I like to enjoy. Like the Drew Carey Show came out in 95.
Yep.
News Radio, Sliders. We were big fans of Sliders, back then. And Xena Warrior Princess, like you said already, that was one I watched the entire thing and bought all the DVDs when they came out and things, and actually never watched it again after I bought the DVDs. Yeah. But
I became a huge X-Files fan later on. It not in 95. I think it probably would have been, 98 when I started watching the X-Files. But that, what a series. I have that all on DVD. I bought the whole box set. Should probably do like a round of rewatching it, to be honest.
Yeah, actually, I'm getting close, because after we get done rewatching Fringe, which we're getting close to, I think X-Files will be our next one to rewatch together and things. So I look forward to that, because there were the cheesy weekly monster ones, but I like the overarching themes and the Cancer Man and the Lone Gunman. And it got to be a pretty fun series.
It was a pretty good formula, honestly, because it was the first episode and the last episode of the season would be continuity episodes, and then the middle would be Monster of the Week, which is fun as well.
That's how I got dragged into Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah,
not quite yet, but I watched a couple episodes of Buffy, and they were like, "Who's gonna watch this show? Buffy the Vampire Slayer got a show?" And then I watched like a couple episodes, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm hooked." Any other television shows that aren't on the list that you can remember fondly, or even in a TV miniseries or anything like that?
No, I'm trying to remember when the Lonesome Dove series was like out. My dad tried to make me watch that, and I was like, this is so boring. This is one of the worst things I've ever seen. I think he must have had it on like VHS, and he would try to make me watch that at some point around this age. And I was like, this is not for me.
That's what I've been doing with my son. I've been, as you probably know, I've been introducing him to the films that I feel are necessary in life and thing. And he doesn't go for blood or dystopian. So I've got to limit a lot of them. You know, like there's so many movies I want to show him, but they've got blood and violence and things, and he cringes at that kind of thing. So I'm almost to the end of the list, but it's the same kind of thing. Sometimes every once in a while I'll show him and he's like, hey.
Yeah, it's funny. My youngest is 15 right now, and she likes almost all of the music that I share with her, but she does not have really much interest in most of the movies that I show her. She's like, this is whatever.
We actually briefly touched on that last podcast with a friend. He was in 1974. He was 14. We talk about the cultural impact of film and television in regards to shared experiences. And I think honestly, now with so many choices of media and TikToks being a minute or less, and YouTube videos being very short, that watching a full-length movie is difficult for a lot of kids these days.
She likes comic book movies quite a lot, like especially sort of the Marvel stuff, but not, she could care less about Star Wars, or I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that I've shown her from my youth. And she's like, yeah, okay. It's like, whatever, you know, and Star Wars isn't even from my generation, you know. Star Wars was 77. Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
Well, and that's actually one of the reasons I started this podcast as well, because I want to see, because with 14, by 1995, I was 24 years old. And so my experience and your experience, you're 14, you're 10 years younger than me. Your decade of less experience in the world is interesting, because your experiences with different shows and movies is going to be something that I learn from.
It's interesting what carries over into subsequent generations, or, you know, what appeals to previous generations within like a slice of time like this.
I call it the Star Wars effect. So you mentioned Star Wars earlier. For us, at least, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, those are our core. That's what we base our love of Star Wars on. But newer generations, so maybe, you know, kids around this time, well, around this time frame, would have been Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, and Revenge of the Sith. You know, those three. But those three, to me, are like almost painful to watch, because they're just not the real Star Wars.
So it would have been right around this time that, like, so the very first movie that I ever went to was Return of the Jedi, but I was 2 years old and therefore did not remember it. But the first time that I remember seeing the Star Wars movies is my parents went to a video store to rent videos, and my brother and I chose A New Hope. And we watched it, and then we went, got Empire Strikes Back, then we went back and got Return of the Jedi, and then we became obsessed. We, speaking of the early internet, we somehow found like a Star Wars fan page, and we accessed the fan page, and then they had links to various websites which had various fan-related stuff on it, one of which was a comprehensive list of all of the mistakes and bloopers in those three movies, and we printed out the whole list on our dot matrix printer and then rented all the movies again and watched through them all and tried to find every single one of the mistakes and bloopers that happen. So we were primed to sort of love Star Wars. And then I was 18, I think, when The Phantom Menace came out, or maybe 17, about to turn 18. And it was such a disappointment.
Yeah.
There are people who are a few years younger than me who are like, oh man, I love the prequel trilogy. And I just can't understand it exactly.
And the funny thing is that they are retroactively fixing it through different things. So like the Clone Wars, the animated series, in the last season or so, actually retroactively story-wise fixed things like in Revenge of the Sith and everything, to where it's like, okay, it's actually not horrible now knowing this, but yeah, to have to fix it 20 years later or 30 years later it seems like that's just the wrong, you know, path. But of course now with Andor, I haven't seen the rest of this, I'm still four episodes behind, but
oh man,
Andor giving that whole lead up into A New Hope and obviously Rogue One is kind of like, ooh, this is cool, you know.
Yeah. Oh, Andor is incredible. I'm a little bit disappointed that they, because it was initially going to be a 5-season show. And I guess during negotiations for season 2, that was decided it wasn't going to happen. I think it's probably because this was a very expensive show to make. And so they condensed those 4 seasons into 1 season. And it suffers for that, but it's still such a well-written show, such an incredibly well-written show.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. Anyhow, we're going forward.
We can talk about it. Yeah, we're getting off topic here. Yeah,
I mentioned before we recorded this, I might do a Star Wars retroactive or a Star Wars versus Star Trek for a season ender for this podcast. Maybe we'll just do Star Wars and talk about, I'll get someone from our, you know, from my generation, yep, you know, middle of the, you know, the Phantom Menace generation and the new horrible piece of junk films, and compare notes.
Right.
Okay, so television shows, you didn't think of any others there. Want to move on to music? I assume, yep, that your music style was not the hip-hop, TLC, Coolio, that kind of, you know, music.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because, again, my parents, music was even more, I guess, enforced in that, like, my brother and I, we're not allowed to own CDs or tapes that were not Christian music. We couldn't listen. We could, like, we would go to our friend's house or like whatever in the ambient world, we would hear TLC or we would hear, you know, other stuff, but we didn't own any music that was not Christian music. So like DC Talk was huge for me at this point, but it was a bunch of other stuff like Stephen Curtis Chapman and Amy Grant, yeah, like people like that were kind of big for me in 1995. Although this was the point where my brother and I kind of started to branch out. Like DC Talk was not a thing my parents listened to. And we listened to stuff like, gosh, I'm trying to think of some of the bands that were active in the mid-90s that were Christian bands. Oh, Sixpence None the Richer was like a band that was on Christian radio first and then ended up on secular radio, or I think Jars of Clay was slightly later. I think that was like 1996 or 97 when they started doing their thing. Stuff like that started to seep into 14, I think, is when you begin to develop your own style or sense of individuality. You know, sometimes it happens for people earlier than that, but I think most people, this is kind of when you begin to become yourself and separate yourself from your parents, distance yourself from what they want and what they do. But it is funny, like all of these songs, every single one of these are ones that I recognize, you know, Gangster's Paradise. What was the name of that movie that this was in? It was like Michelle Pfeiffer was a teacher. Dangerous Minds. Yeah. Like a lot of these are movie songs. Kiss from a Rose by Seal was in Batman Forever, right?
Yep, I think that Batman was Forever, yep.
You could not escape. I need to impress upon people how ubiquitous fantasy by Mariah Carey was. not just in 1995, but for the next like 10 years, that song was everywhere. Yeah. Everywhere.
I was out of the music store by this point in time, but yeah, Mariah Carey dominated, and so she was like always on. I crushed on Mariah Carey back in her early days before she went crazy and married that Sony exec, whatever.
Yeah,
you know? And back then she was, you know, cute, and her music was, you know, pop, but you know, she had a good voice. But yeah, this was everywhere, like you said.
Yeah, also somewhat similar, Shaggy with Boombastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of that Rasta rap thing that was going on about that time. Well, I guess that kind of extended from the early 90s, because that's when we got 12 inches of snow from the white Canadian rapper who did Informer.
Oh, yeah, Informer. Yep.
Informer, yeah. Yeah, that was huge in the early to mid 90s for some reason. I don't
know.
12 inches of snow.
I remember owning the TLC album that Waterfalls and Creep was on. I can't remember what the album name was, but I had bought that on CD. And back then, buying CDs, even though I worked at a music store, buying CDs was still somewhat expensive.
Yeah.
And then I had done a trip to Cripple Creek for something. It wasn't for gambling because I was too young, but done a trip to Cripple Creek for some reason, and then left my CD case on top of the car.
Oh, no.
And then when that album was gone, I was like, no.
So this story comes from a year later, but when I was 15 years old, my brother and I went on a church trip thing where we like gathered with a bunch of other youth groups from different churches. And my brother and I brought his boombox and our collective collection of CDs, which would have been probably 100 CDs in this big booklet. And we brought it along in this trip and played music from it or whatever. And one day when we were out on some kind of like whatever team building exercise for teenagers, somebody stole that booklet, like the whole thing. And so my collection of contemporary Christian music just vanished. But one of the youth group leaders had a sister who worked for the Christian music division of Boston Music Group. And she felt bad for us and like emailed her sister and was like, hey, can you like get together some free CDs and send them over for these kids who got their stuff stolen? And so it was still Christian music, but this was very different Christian music. This was MXPX, which was like a pop punk band. We got the Orange County Supertones, which was a ska band. It was a sampler CD that had the very first Switchfoot single on it. So this was like 1996, I think it was. So yeah. And like a bunch of other stuff like that. And so this opened like a whole new world to my brother and I. It shaped, it's such a random event, but that little random event completely changed the trajectory of our lives, to be honest, because it introduced us to a whole new genres of music that we didn't know existed or were familiar with. And it ended up like we became friends with people who listened to this kind of music as a result, because it was such a, these were, I mean, ska was exploding in the 90s, but we were sort of brought into these niche groups, these niche friend groups. And again, like that introduced us to secular bands who played the same kind of music, you know, Lagwagon and Less Than Jake and things like that. So just a random event that totally changed our lives was somebody stealing our hundred contemporary Christian CDs.
So what you're saying is it's double divine intervention. First, the CDs were stolen, and then as a result, this new line of music was your new pursuit. And so it was divine intervention times two.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy stuff. But yeah, I would have been. Actually, I might have still been 14, because if it was before August, I might have still been 14. Actually,
it's a good story right there, because you know, it's these new venues, these new avenues that we find that are the ones that sometimes define us. And like you said, 14 is when that's one of the reasons I chose this age, is because we are coming into ourselves. And so just finding this new style, hey, that changed your trajectory in life.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And it's pretty crazy how that happens.
Any other music from this time frame that you can think of?
No, I mean, again, like pretty abysmal, honestly, the things that I was listening to at that point. Jeff Moore in the Distance and stuff of that nature, stuff that nobody's going to remember or has no cultural impact at all.
Striper was too late.
It was too late for Striper. We did, you know, kind of get into that Christian heavy stuff, but that wasn't until I was like 17 or 18. So.
Okay, well, now the good thing I'm looking forward to here is that you say you are a computer guy and a video game guy, and you had different things in 1995. There were some great video games and arcade games that were out in 1995.
Oh, yeah. I like NBA Jam was, I think NBA Jam was a little bit earlier than this, but it stuck around. It was you could put codes in to make the players' heads huge, or make the ball be on fire all the time, or make everybody really small, like just weird stuff. It was such a strange, it's because it's just a basketball game, right? But there was just all these strange little details to it. And it was, you played 2-on-2 was the primary format of the game. And then you picked, you know, basically team players. So it would be like the Boston Celtics or the Chicago Bulls, and it would be sort of two of the best players from that team would be against two of the best players from another team. And if you got three, I want to say if you got three slam dunks in a row, then you were on fire and the ball would be on fire. And just such a, I don't know, I played an insane amount of that game. Was Sonic and Knuckles 1995? I can't remember now.
Genesis was either out or coming out real soon. No, Genesis was there because Rystar came out in 95.
Yeah. I mean, Sonic 1, Sonic 2, Sonic 3 all came out pretty close together to one another, as I recall. Well, I think Sonic 1 was on the Sega Master System, which then became the Genesis. Gosh, it's been so long. But no, those games were classic. I mean, unbelievable. Sonic 2, I think, was my favorite.
And I don't think people realize from this point in time that the power of these gaming systems for time, it felt almost like you had an arcade in your room, because Sonic was so fast-paced and the graphics were cool, and it was like you were in an arcade. So the change from the Nintendo, just the plain Nintendo, to the Sega Genesis and even the Dreamcast, and things, but well, Dreamcast is a little bit down the road. It was like, wow, you know, look at this. You know, I don't have to go to the arcade. I can play as much as I want to and stuff, and find all the secret hidden areas and everything like that. Oh yeah, Sonic Rock.
And they had was it the 32X, the little extension that you stuck into your Sega Genesis?
Oh yeah,
made it 32-bit instead of 16-bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a couple of weird things that happened around this time. Like Neo Geo, I think, was also around this time as well, which was at the time the most powerful gaming system, and so it was wildly expensive. But you more or less got to play arcade games in your house with that one. I think that one was 32 bits, and it was, I forget how much it was, but a wild price on that one.
I never had a Neo Geo. I had the Sega Genesis.
Yep.
I had my PC, and I had the PlayStation.
We had, so our Mike, the kid who had all the, let us watch and listen to all the things we weren't supposed to. He had a Super Nintendo, and we had a Sega Genesis, and we would just go across the street and play one another's systems when we wanted to try something out. It's funny, Chrono Trigger is on this list. I didn't play Chrono Trigger in 1995. However, in the early 2000s, when emulators became a thing, I loved Chrono Trigger. So for people who don't know, who aren't big nerds, you can download emulators which mimic the operating system of the Super Nintendo or the Nintendo or the Sega Genesis or whatever it is you want to play. And then you can download what they call ROMs, which are the games themselves. And they generally function in a fairly stable way. Sometimes they are a bit janky, but you can do things on an emulator that you could not do on the original game, such as like have a save state in the middle of the game rather than find, because at this point, saving games was on in some ways a luxury. Like most 8-bit and 16-bit systems did not have the ability to save a game. And if they did, it was only at save points. Like you had to get to a certain point. Or like in the case of the original Nintendo, mostly you got to a certain level and then they gave you a code that you had to write down. And then when you came back to the game, you could start over and put that code in and jump back to the level you had gotten to. And so these emulators and ROMs allowed you to save at any point in the middle of the game. But yeah, no, Chrono Trigger is an amazing game if you haven't played it. It's a really good sort of Japanese RPG, a good example of that style from that era. But no, I did not play that at the time. Very good. Command and Conquer, however, my brother and I played a lot of Command and Conquer. Even more so, we played Command and Conquer Red Alert, which came out a couple of years after that. We played a wild amount of Red Alert.
Tim Curry?
Yes, yeah, playing the like wild Soviet leader. It was pretty funny. He said at the very end of the game, when you're playing the Allies side, he's like, I'm going to the one place that hasn't been poisoned by capitalism, space.
Yep. Yeah, Command and Conquer, I played many, many hours of that and Warcraft.
And then another one that's 1995 was Full Throttle. Getting back to George Lucas here. Lucas Arts was the video game division of George Lucas's Lucasfilm, and they dominated the point and click adventure games at this point. They did, because this was Monkey Island, Day of the Tentacle, Full Throttle, Grim Fandango, all incredible games, but Full Throttle might be my favorite, to be honest. And it's got there's a section kind of in the middle of the game where you have to do a destruction derby. And one of the people that you fight against is based on George Lucas. And at the time, this was before the prequels had come out. And so we didn't know what they were going to look like, but he had been talking about for years making the prequel series. And so my brother and I, it was our, in our imagination, we were destroying him for not having released the prequels in 1995.
Yeah, I loved all those games. I mean, I have recently replayed Day of the Tentacle and Grim Fandango, and I keep meaning to go back to play Full Throttle because I've got them all on the PlayStation now. I keep meaning to go back and play Full Throttle again, but I haven't gotten around to it.
And Killer Instinct was ported to consoles in 95, but that was one of my favorite arcade games. It was just a very weird fighting game. Like it was like dinosaurs and gorillas and whatever. It was a bizarre game, honestly.
I would always play not Velociraptor, but the dinosaur in that one.
Yep. Yeah. Always. Of course. Like I said, Jurassic Park was my favorite movie for a long time. So
I think one of the ones I had, which I loved, and you talk about dominating of games, LucasArts, yes, they were doing fantastic then as well, but Sierra still had some of the best games. And so one of the ones on here is Phantasmagoria, which I loved back then.
Yeah, no, I did not play Phantasmagoria, but Sierra were the ones who...
King's Quest, Space Quest, Police Quest, all of those.
I'm trying to remember what Sierra games then I played, because I didn't play Phantasmagoria.
They were starting their downfall in 95 because they were so great for so long on the PC, and I played all those games. The funny thing is now, like you're talking about the ROMs and things, if you try to go back and play like King's Quest 1, problem is that the power of the machines back then versus now is slightly different. And
just
so
slightly.
You push like right to move your character right, and you're 5, 6, 7 screens, before you can even, stop.
One of my friends had Leisure Suit Larry, which was it was a very crass game for that time. The hell was I playing on?
You were spending time with your family in front of the TV playing Leisure Suit Larry.
No, this was Mike, the same kid over and over again.
Mike sounds like a good guy.
Mike, yeah, I wonder what he's up to.
Some other ones for me, at least at this time. Again, I had the PlayStation, so Twisted Metal. My wife and I actually played Twisted Metal together. That's one of the few games that we've ever played together. So we used to play Twisted Metal a bunch. That was fun. And then the new series on Peacock, I think it is, the first season was kind of fun to watch.
You know, I thought it was fun. Yeah. I didn't play Twisted Metal until probably 97 or 98. It was on the original PlayStation, but I think it might've been Twisted Metal 2.
For me, one other one that was big was Descent. Descent was one of the first.
Oh yeah.
You really had to, well, you had to, I had the joystick, the, you know, flight stick, and it was definitely more than just a plain old 3D game, because you had to, you know, account for, you know, not gravity, but you had to account for multiple directions, up, down, left, right, yep, you know, spinning, strafing, the whole shebang. And so, you know, I got pretty darn good at Descent, and a lot of my friends were like, how do you do that? I'm like, I'm just costing.
I want to say that I played a version of Descent that was on the Commodore 64, but maybe I'm misremembering that. It might have been after we got the, because my dad, like I said, again, my dad was very cheap, but he thought it was very important for my brother and I to have access to the latest sort of computer technology. No, that was 95. Holy. Yeah. So that had to be on our very high quality 386 SX, mm-hmm, I think it was. That's 386,000 bytes, mm-hmm, of processing power. Yep. Yeah. Incredible.
Two megabytes of RAM.
I don't even think it was that much. I think we were still in the maybe it's 1 megabyte of RAM. I can't remember. It was nothing. It was virtually nothing.
Let's see. I worked at Egghead Software in 92.
Yeah.
And I remember selling the RAM, you know, RAM, and but we also sold the hard drives. And in 1992. A 300 megabyte hard drive was still going for around $800 or $900.
Crazy, right? I mean, just absolutely, yeah, crazy.
CD-ROMs, I think we had the 1X, and then when the 2X CD-ROM came out, that's when you could really play those LucasArts games. You know, like, ooh, look at that. You know, look at how fast that is.
What was the other, Babbage's? I was trying to think of the other name of the weird computer stores that they had back in the 90s. Babbage's Software, I think it was. So we bought Myst from Babbage's. I don't think it was 93. I think it was 94 or 95 maybe when we got that. That was a wild game. Another point and click game.
Game is what that game was.
Yeah. Like insane,
visually beautiful.
Insane, yeah, puzzles. Insane puzzles.
I was never a giant fan of Myst because the puzzles were just so random.
Yeah, and very obscure. And once you figure out the ending, you can end the game without doing any of the puzzles, because the method of doing so is just going down the hill to the weird cave thing and putting in a code there.
Okay, any other video games? I mean, they've got a lot of great ones. Like I said, Command & Conquer was huge. In the arcades, you know, Mortal Kombat 3 had come out. I'm sure that you played that plenty.
at my friend's house, not at ours. Yeah.
You know, Mike, like I said, sounds like a great guy.
Yeah, he was. He opened a lot of doors for my brother and I.
But I think go back one real quick second here again. The people don't realize, you know, 1995 with these new machines, the PCs were getting stronger. I mean, like you said, a 386, you know, SX nonetheless.
Was, yeah, not the DX, the SX.
Yeah, no, the SX was the peak of technology at the time, but you could play a lot of games on it still, especially if, yep, you had a friend that knew how to manipulate the BIOS and change, oh, yeah, the RAM and, you know, figure out how to adjust it and things. Thankfully I had that friend. But the thing that we can't help but drive home in 95 is that transfer of video gaming from the arcade to the home, because we, yeah, did have a lot more options. Nintendo by itself, I mean, that was really cool to be able to play Mario and all those at home, but it just wasn't like the same as being in an arcade. And these ones that start coming home, they start to be, oh, I can do this at home. You know, I don't need to put quarters in the machine anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and it's pretty much, yeah, that was it. It was almost the same quality. Not quite, but almost the same quality as what you could get in an arcade. And it wasn't too much after this that it was equivalent. It was the same. Like you were getting the same visual sort of fidelity, same sort of frame rates, same kind of graphical quality. Like everything was identical. And so people just stopped going to arcades in the late 90s, really.
That's kind of sad though at the same time, because those were experiences that I would never give up.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had a lot of fun at the arcade, but it does, it is also, they were designed to eat your quarters, you know what I mean? They were designed to be so hard that unless you were just very good at these twitch reactions at the last second, you were likely going to have to feed many dollars into the machine at a time just to get through the first few levels, you know?
I think I probably put Don Bluth's kids through college with as many quarters as I put into
King's Quest.
Yeah, Dragon's Quest.
Or Dragon's Quest, yeah.
Okay, so I think that's good with video games. You know, that's it's fun reminiscing with those, because so far the ones I've had conversations with, a lot of our focus has been on TV and movies, but being that you had that upraising of having that technology in the house, it's good to have someone that's experienced these the same as I have.
Yeah, exactly.
Fashion trends? What did you wear as a 14-year-old?
I was not very cool in 1995. So baggy jeans were huge at this point, and I didn't wear baggy jeans until I was older. I had two pairs of JNCOs when I was 17 and 18, one of which my 15-year-old now wears on a regular basis because they're cool again for some reason. But I did start wearing flannel over a t-shirt. Like, it would be like an unbuttoned flannel shirt with a t-shirt underneath it. That was pretty cool at this time, and I was doing that.
I can see you wearing that. Yep.
Oh yeah. I had this t-shirt that was like a comic panel that was a drawing. The title was Moses at an Early Age, and it was this child in a kiddie pool, but the water was parted on both sides of him, and I wore that shirt until it fell apart. I thought that was like the coolest shirt that had ever been made. There's this kind of joke about how everybody in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, had a starter jacket, and if you didn't have a team that was your team, you had for some reason had a Charlotte Hornets jacket, and my brother had one. I didn't have those. Chain wallets, again, that's another thing I think I started doing when I was 16 or 17, yep. And that was a thing, but not when I was 14. I still wasn't quite cool enough.
I was going to ask you specifically about chain wallets, because I can see you wearing a chain wallet.
Oh, yeah. And I got the fattest, because they still sold choke collars for dogs at this point.
Yep.
And so I got the biggest, fattest choke chain that I could that I could find, and then I like hooked it to my wallet and to my belt with a key ring. I took a communications course. So we learned how to use PowerPoint. One of the things we learned how to do was make business cards. And I made a chain gang business card, which was like, and this was when off the chain was like a cool phrase to say, this is off the chain. And so that was like, it was like, welcome to the chain gang, we're off the chain. And then it was like a clip art picture of a chain. I forget what else was on that card. And I made, I think, I don't know, 100 of these business cards and distributed it to various people. I think I still have like a stack of them in a box somewhere. But yeah, no, again, not when I was 14, but a few years later I did get in on that. I mean, so I remember all of these.
You brought up clip art. You know, clip art, that's something that's now long gone. I can't even think of the last time I thought about clip art.
Clip art is still around. It's just nobody calls it that and nobody thinks about it. But like, if you go into Microsoft Word or whatever, there are default images, sort of not photographs, but like pieces of simple drawings or whatever that you can insert into your paper or your poster or whatever. But yeah, nobody thinks about it or calls it clip art. It's just images.
So now the only other things here on this list that I can imagine you. So you had the flannel over the t-shirt.
Yep.
You had some baggy jeans, not too many. Now, at the chain wallet, I can see you now. Question here is, were you a Doc Martin boots person or a Vans person?
Oh, neither. I was a Chuck Taylor's person at this
point. Oh, really?
The classic. And it's funny, Chuck Taylor's never went out of style. Since the point at which they came on the scene, they've always been cool to a certain like group sort of subcultures, indie, punk rock folks have always, I feel like, worn Chuck Taylors from the 80s onward, at least.
I see it now, but
yeah.
I personally would have thought you would have been a Vans person, but
I was later when I was like 18, 19, 20, 21, somewhere around there. I started wearing Vans, but no, before that, I did have Airwalks. That was a very 90s brand. But I think mm-hmm. the first pair that I got of Airwalks was 1996. I got jealous of my cousin who had a Hypercolor shirt. No, I didn't, because those were stupid expensive, just insane. I want to say they were like $50 a t-shirt or something crazy like that in the 90s.
In the 90s, I mean, that's like $100 t-shirt
now. Oh yeah, 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 wild, just wild stuff.
I had my starter jacket. Now this is back before the Colorado Avalanche were around. Or actually, maybe they were getting close, but I had my starter jacket. I had a San Jose Sharks starter jacket.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was another one that for some reason was pretty popular, I think, too.
Because they were cool looking.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably why the Hornets were popular too, because they were is kind of a neat logo, especially for that era. And the colors were purple and green, or purple and blue, or
purple something. Like something that. Yeah,
yeah, something that was the colors that were cool in the 90s.
Okay, so I think clothes we got a good grasp on there. I can definitely picture you as that. How about commercials and advertising campaigns? There was a huge one that year, which lasted forever in advertising. The one I'm referring to is the Budweiser Frogs commercial.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, the Budweiser. Yeah, no, I remember that one. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other ones that were...
Another big one here was the Windows 95 launch campaign.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, and that was another one that was ubiquitous, another thing that just kept like popping up everywhere. And they got a lot of flack. The Windows 95 got a lot of flack because they were like, oh, you're just copying the Apple OS. And I'm like, well, I mean, I guess it's just a button and icons, you know, because prior to this, Microsoft computers, you know, IBMs and whatever ran on DOS. And then we had Windows 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 3.1, 3.11, like, and then Windows 95 just it because you had the start button was I think was the big innovation there, but it was not a very stable system. It crashed a lot
shortly after Microsoft Bob came out too.
Oh my god. Crazy.
Most people listening to this podcast probably have no idea Microsoft Bob. Almost as bad as, you know, having Clippy in your screen later on.
Oh man, Clippy was an adventure.
nice way to put it.
Yeah, it's not dissimilar to AI assistants in modern devices. You know, he would pop up and be like, "It looks like you're trying to write a form letter. Would you like some help with that?" And he would just be on the screen in front of whatever you're trying to do, which is kind of annoying.
How long before ChatGPT gets to that stage where this pops up in your screen? Hey, look at this.
Yeah. Hey, would you like me to help you with such and such? No, thank you. I'm good. I'll ask your help if I need it.
Yeah. They had the Got Milk campaign during 95.
Yep. Yeah, which was it was a bunch of celebrities, models, sports personalities with like milk on their upper lip. Which was kind of a weird thing to do, to be honest.
If you have a mustache, sure. If you're no mustache, it's not so much.
It's kind of strange. Yeah, a little bit weird.
It's sticky milk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see too many others. Obey Your Thirst from Sprite was a one.
Yeah, yep. That one continued for a while, too. That was another one that had a lot of celebrity people showing up in the campaign as part of it, where it would be like... So-and-so, whatever basketball player would be like chugging a Sprite. Obey your thirst.
They tried to make Sprite cool.
Yeah, yeah. And this was also the era of very edgy commercials, especially when it came to stuff like video games, stuff like Doom or Mortal Kombat or whatever had very like edgy kind of advertising campaigns. And that's another thing that continued like well into the late 90s as well. A lot of extreme. The word extreme was popular in the 90s.
Especially the PlayStation versus Nintendo and all that. And it was always like, PlayStation versus Genesis versus Nintendo. It was always your face. Lots of zooming in with the camera and zooming out. Loud.
A lot of metal riffs over teenagers disobeying their parents and stuff like that. Yeah.
So let's see. Moving on then. I threw this category in recently just because it's so fun. But some of the foods that came out in '95 or were popular in '95.
Okay, what you got?
Lunchables. They were still popular. Yep. They're still around, obviously.
Terrible. Yeah. Every one of them is terrible.
There's salt with some more salt and a little piece of candy in there to balance the salt.
Very bad slices of meat, very flavorless pizza sauce, the most disgusting bread you've ever tasted, the most crumbly crackers.
Yeah, they're MREs in kid form.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're talking about the really extreme commercials. Surge Soda came out.
Oh, yeah.
Extra caffeine, green.
Which, like, before, I think Jolt was before Surge, and so that was already a thing, but Surge was like, oh my god, it was like Mountain Dew times two or something crazy like that.
I think some restaurants, maybe Taco Bell, I can't remember, somebody brought it back in the last like few years. I don't know if it's still there or not, but yeah, Surge is still around.
Yeah, no, it was, and they were, it's kind of like there were iterations of basically this same design over the many years, and they tried to market them directly at young teenage boys. So like Mountain Dew was like that, and then Surge was like that, and then when I was in my early 20s, there was a soda called Balls, BAWLS. It came in a weird blue bottle. Balls was marketed as like gamer fuel. Yeah, I don't know.
I vaguely remember that. Vaguely. Yep. Stuffed crust pizza from Pizza Hut came around and was advertised by Donald Trump.
Yep. It was basically just string cheese rolled into crust is pretty much all it was. Just mozzarella, like a strip of mozzarella rolled into your crust.
Yeah. Although it's still around and it's still fairly popular. I didn't think it's just, the cheese doesn't melt right. So it's always just kind of like, by the time you get chewy. It to the table, it's just cold cheese inside bread.
Yeah, I think I convinced my parents to pay for it once, and then they never did again.
more outrageous commercials with gushers.
Oh my gosh! Yeah,
you bite into them and they explode in your mouth.
And didn't it make like people's face turn red and like expand or something? I'm trying to remember exactly how those commercials functioned.
yep. And then the last one I want to bring up, at least, unless you can think of others, is the disaster of Crystal Pepsi.
Yes, that was a weird one. Yeah, that soda companies were trying real hard to do new things, because we had New Coke a little bit before this, which everybody hated. Then that sort of just vanished off the planet. And then Crystal Pepsi was another one where they just stopped adding caramel color to Pepsi, and everybody hated that too. It was they tried real hard to make it cool. They pushed that real hard with a massive advertising campaign, and people just were like, "Meh, not into this."
Any other foods that you craved when you were a teen?
My mother was really weird about processed foods when I was young, and so it was a matter of like having to like use my own money on it or having to get it from a friend. So I did not get to enjoy most of the fun, weird stuff that happened during this time period. I want to say, I think it was 1996. Do you remember Orbitz?
Gum?
No, it was a drink that had little like tapioca balls that would float in the beverage.
Hey.
Yeah, they came in like glass bottles, I think. Clearly Canadian. That's another thing that was like huge in the 90s.
You can get them in the grocery stores now.
I know, and I loved those when I was a kid. I tried one not too long ago, and I was like, it's not as good as I remember it.
Same.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's like they changed the recipe or if I just if I'm not a child anymore, but
they're just too carbonated.
Yeah.
Well, and you didn't go over to Mike's and have snacks over at his house?
I like I said, yeah, probably, but you know, nothing I guess memorable enough for me to know what it was now.
Okay, then we'll go ahead and move on to slang then. Slang in 95, very similar early 90s. The slang doesn't change too much over time, but you had a few phrases that were fun.
Yeah, this was tubular was not cool anymore, but you could still say rad, I think, by 1995. Yeah, like I said, off the chain. There was a lot of like adoption in the mid-90s, I think, of what had been cool for street culture in the late 80s, early 90s.
The film Clueless really brought around a whole bunch of these.
Valley, you know, yeah, Valley Girl stuff was also huge around this time as well. Yeah, that kind of like, as if, gag me with a spoon.
And whatever.
Whatever, yeah, no, that was a thing. This was also around the time when the whole not was...
Still
know,
Wayne's World.
Still a thing, yep. Yeah, you'd be like, oh... You know, I really like your shirt. Not, yeah, for some reason. Psych. Psych was also, that was pretty much the same vibe. You'd be like, yeah. Oh, man.
And I talked about that in, I think, the first podcast, the transfer from psych to not. You know, there's that transfer, yeah, over, you know, the handoff to the not.
It's the same joke, yeah. It's the same, exactly. Same exact joke, just a slight variation, yeah.
And I think that's what it is with all the slang over the course of time. It's just what we understand and what the kids understand. You know, once the adults start using the slang, that's when it starts changing to something new.
It's funny though, because the word "cool" has been cool since like the 1950s. That never went away. It's kind of interesting how all these phrases kind of come and go, but "cool" remains cool.
I'm trying to think of a negative that actually might have remained over the years, but I can't think of one.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. So let's see, some fads of 95. Beanie Babies.
Oh, man. Yeah, Beanie Babies hit like critical mass a couple of years after this. They were coming up around 95, and then I think it was 98 or 99 when the bubble burst.
Yeah. And, I watched that faux documentary.
Yes.
And it was interesting to see how actually it could still be going, technically speaking, if greed wasn't such a factor in it.
Yeah. Yeah. They overproduced them and it's such a strange thing though. Like if you didn't live through this time, you cannot believe how psychotic grown adults were about pieces of cloth around beans. I mean, it was just, and they were small and they weren't like, I'm sure the ones that were handmade initially were really well done, but they weren't even particularly well made. But if you look at like pictures of this, there are situations where people would be getting a divorce and they would have to spend hours arguing over their Beanie Baby collection and who gets which Beanie Baby. Wild stuff. Absolutely wild stuff.
Well, I compared it earlier on to the Cabbage Patch Kids craze, you know, where people were tackling each other over Cabbage Patch Kids. But now, in recent, like this year, the Pokemon cards, there's like a new season or a new, I don't know what you call them, but people are going into Costco and just grabbing pallets fulls of these things, and people are like losing their minds over this.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There's a movie that came out shortly after this called Jingle All the Way, which is Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to get his son a Turbo Man doll. Yeah, and the scenes that happen in that movie seem ridiculous, but that is how it was with stuff like the Cabbage Patch dolls and the Pound Puppies and the Beanie Babies. There was a something going on mentally with the with Americans around this time period. I don't know what it was.
It's the what you can't get, you have to have thing.
Yeah, but unbelievable.
Macarena, that one was
released, oh my God,
in Spain in 95.
Yeah, that was so that was both a song and a dance that went along with it, and everybody was doing it. This was that's another thing that's kind of not really a thing anymore. It's these choreographed dance things that everybody's doing, like the mm-hmm. electric slide, the boot scoot and boogie. People were doing, wasn't there like a dance that went along with the achy breaky heart? I feel like that was like that had one, and then the Macarena.
That one I remember I read around this time because I went to Disney World around this time. They used to have the Adults Island. I can't remember what it's called. It was like where they had all these things. But they had somebody out there teaching everybody to do the Macarena. I didn't know what it was at the time. But yeah, I learned the Macarena back in the day.
Yep. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it was almost impossible not to learn the Macarena. Like you'd have to have your head in the sand for that not to have like seeped into your brain through osmosis at the very least.
And that's one of those ones you can just say the word and immediately that song gets in your head.
Yep. Hey,
any other fads of this time that really stand out to you? I got the list there.
I think the only one and I think this was just a few years earlier as well, but pogs mm-hmm. were, but yeah, again, by this point, I think pogs were already not cool again. Or was it after this? When were pogs like the thing?
It says here they were still riding high as the top playground collectible in early 95.
Okay. Yeah. So I think it probably was like 93 or 94. Yeah. Little circles made of cardboard and then metal or plastic slammers. I had one that was, it was like metal and it had like little blades that went all the way around it. And then it had a hologram of a Tyrannosaurus Rex skull. And then if you like turned it, it like shifted from like the head of a Tyrannosaurus to just its bones. That was about the coolest. I think I still have my pogs again somewhere, but
oh, no.
Yeah.
Didn't take you for a hoarder.
No, I think there's something, cause my dad was in the Air Force. And so we moved, especially around this time, I think I moved every year of high school. I was in a different place every year of high school. So I think there were just certain things that I clung to, some certain objects that I was like, whatever, nothing was permanent for me. So that was the thing.
I was a military brat as well. And I moved around quite a bit. So I understand that. My mom actually, she likes to keep a lot of stuff, just over the years and things too.
The reason I still have my JNCOs is because my mom had them and she gave them back to me like 5 years ago. And I was like, what am I going to do with these? And then like immediately thereafter, JNCOs became cool again. And my kids stole them. So
maybe you could have sold them for a nice profit.
Oh, I probably could have. The original JNCOs are going for stupid amounts of money.
I think maybe it's time to distract your daughter and then
Oh yeah. Cause the ones she stole are the ones that people want, which are like the ones with the skinny waist and the enormous bell bottoms. It's like, I wouldn't say that I'm like a bigger guy now, but I was insanely skinny then. I think it was a 28 inch waist and these are 36 inch bottoms, so just a crazy variance between the top and the bottom of those things.
You can climb up them like a tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they've got gigantic pockets, so you can put a laptop in those pockets.
So let's see, at 14, I always like to throw this one on just because sometimes we still remember the news stories of 14. They're not as prevalent in our lives, but there are sometimes ones that really kind of still stick with us over the years kind of thing. Was there anything in 95 as a 14-year-old that you really remember about the news at the time?
I remember pretty vividly like a couple of things. The O.J. Simpson trial was going on at this time. A lot. It was like a media circus, and mm-hmm. the him trying on the glove, or like even him running from the cops in his white Bronco. That was everywhere. If the glove does not fit, you must acquit. That's pretty like funny stuff going on there. The Oklahoma City bombing. Also, I can remember this, and it's probably just because my parents had the news on all the time. But like I can remember the initial reports being that this was like Islamic fundamental terrorism initially, that's who they were looking for, Islamic fundamentalists initially. And then, it came out pretty shortly thereafter that it was It was actually a white supremacist. So
yeah.
Yeah. Just a very different thing.
Always got to find a target.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's mostly it. On the list here, you have the E. coli breakout. I don't really remember that at all. However, a few years later, when I was, again, speaking of the heavy Christian music, there was a band that had a song called E. coli. That was like a Christian new metal band. I cannot for the life of me remember the name of that band, but that just reminded me of that. It's kind of funny. Were people still going postal at this point, or was that was more like 92, 93?
I think that's one of those terms that's been forever around, but I probably read around this time frame.
It's funny because you have those like weird memories that for no reason you remember them. I lived here in Colorado Springs it was like the middle of 91 to towards the end of 95. And I have this like weird memory of driving on Academy Boulevard past where that fire station is at Meadowland, like right after Meadowland.
Yeah. It's very, yeah.
Yeah. There's like a fire station there. And I have this bizarre memory of driving past that fire station. And my mother is listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio. And he's talking about some postal worker going postal. And for some reason, that memory just sticks in my head for no obvious reason. It wasn't remarkable in any way, just a strange combination of things that for some reason sticks in my brain.
Yeah. That's the little things like that are the weird ones. Like you always remember exactly where you were at this point or that point.
Yeah. It's usually because there's like some major thing happens. Like I can remember what was happening when 9/11 happened. I can remember what was going on, you know, when my brother fell down a hill, you know, stuff where it's like something remarkable was going on. But it's weird that I remember this thing where nothing about it is remarkable.
Going postal.
Yes, going postal.
DVDs are announced.
Yeah. My dad, again, my dad was very cheap, and he did not consider media to be terribly like changes in the style or quality of media was not a thing he cared about. So we didn't get a CD player until 1995 was the first time we had a CD player. So we had tapes up to that point. We didn't get a DVD player. We didn't own a DVD player at all, ever, while I was living with them. I myself purchased myself a DVD player when I was 19 years old. So that would have been like 2000. Prior to that, it was all VHS tapes. The anomaly of the computer thing is definitely like it stands out because he was so cheap about everything else.
Well, if you got to have one thing, at least the computer is the cool thing to have.
It is. Or not. Maybe it made me a socially awkward dork.
Yeah. Hey, gives you the brain, the knowledge you need to succeed in the world today.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. I didn't realize that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opened in 1995.
Yeah. That wouldn't have really been on my radar for all the reasons I think I've mentioned up to this point. Rock and roll for me was limited to Christian music pretty much.
Yeah, true. Really, I don't see too much more that stands out in regards to news or things that really kind of
notable were big stuff.
In the time frame. So we've covered pretty much a lot of the big stuff. Was there anything about being 14 that we didn't cover that really kind of defined who you are as a human being?
I don't know. I think it's, you know, and you mentioned this is kind of why you chose it. It's a transitional time, right? Like you are becoming, you're not really a little kid anymore. You're not really an adult anymore. You're not even like a teenager with her own fully formed identity. You're just on your way to that. And that I think is the thing that I remember the most about being 14 is trying to walk that line of like, you know, I would still, when none of my friends are around, play with toys, but that is nothing that I would ever tell them. You know what I mean? Like I still had Jurassic Park toys and I still had Legos and whatever that I would put together, but it's nothing that I would ever let my friends know I was doing, you know?
Yeah, it's one of the categories I've kind of removed from the my lists of things because it's been the same conversation every time, including this one here, is that 14 years old, you're playing with toys, you just can't be cool anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So like you said, it's kind of the underground thing. Legos doesn't matter what age you are, but other toys, yeah, they start disappearing from bedrooms and going into garage sales and the hand-me-downs and things like that.
Or at least into the closet where nobody can see them. I will say, though, that something that my brother and I started doing like right around this time or shortly after this is making stop motion movies with our toys. My dad had bought a VHS, full-size VHS video camera in 1986 or 87 because we had been stationed, my dad had been stationed in England and he wanted to be able to like capture that time when we were there. But from about 1991 onward, he never touched it again because it was, first of all, it was heavy and bulky. And second, he felt like there was not much remarkable going on. So my brother and I took it in like 95 or 96 and started using our toys to make little like short films. And they were, honestly, some of them were pretty complicated and I guess sophisticated considering that I was like 14, 15 and he was 11 or 12. We had a whole thing where Batman, like Bruce Wayne slid down the bat pole into the bat cave and turned into Batman on the way down and then got in the Batmobile and drove away. I don't know. That was fun.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. We talked about video cameras in one other podcast as well, because my friend had a video camera back in the day. And so he filmed the Jaws 5 or whatever it is, the spawning, you know, and we were in the middle of California, so there's no ocean that was nearby.
Right,
stuff.
So right.
It was his backyard and stuff.
Yeah, we filmed stuff of like, you know, whatever Jurassic Park dinosaurs crushing traffic, like cars, little matchbox cars or whatever. But what was crazy is that this video camera, if you couldn't advance frame by frame, so you would have to hit record and record your frame, and then you had to wait exactly 3 seconds and hit the pause button, because then the camera would back up to the point where you would have one frame captured. And we figured that out with trial and error, that it was like, okay, we got to go 1, 2, 3, pause. All right, now we move everything slightly, hit record, 1, 2, 3, pause, and then it would backtrack to just, you know, a frame or maybe two frames. So
that's funny.
Yeah.
I like that.
Great. But yeah, no, that was pretty much my experience as a 14-year-old.
Any wisdom that your 14-year-old can pass on to your younger daughter now, you know, that she needs to learn from your past?
I think you can never be cool by trying to be cool.
Okay.
You just have to kind of be yourself and do your thing. And if people think it's cool, then that's cool. If not, like trying to be cool never works.
I would agree with that. Definitely. But that's just cause I'm too cool for anything. So, you know,
I am now, but, yeah, I was I don't know. It was about this age that I stopped being a socially isolated loner. I spent a lot of time inside on the computer reading, whatever. I began to branch out into being a little more social around this time.
Well, and I think, you know, you've mentioned you're being moving around. I think that's part of being a military brat, is that we have to adapt faster than other people to keep friends. And there is definite times of isolation where you're like, I got to start over again. I've got to start over again. I've got to, you know, and so.
And I think that was kind of my perspective at that time, was like, I can't, like, if I make friends, all I'm going to do is lose them. So what is the point? But I think it was around this time that I was like, well, maybe I just need to make friends quickly and enjoy that. And then, you know, everything is temporary. So what can you do?
Exactly. I agree 100%. And I you know the exact experience. So.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered pretty much everything, unless you have any last moments there.
No, I think that's great.
Okay. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you here, Jeremy. I'm going to go ahead and read the outro in just a moment here. But, you know, it's been really great learning about 95. And some of these things I expected, and some of these things were interesting to me based on my knowledge of you and from at least the one class and yeah. also knowing you since then and things and your posts on Facebook and stuff. So it's good to actually get more depth and knowledge. And it's been a complete pleasure to talk to you. So I appreciate your time and being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
So, okay, great. So, cowabunga, time travelers, that's going to do it for this ride in the Tubular Time Machine. Thanks for cruising back through the raddest years with us. We hope you had as much fun as we did cranking up the nostalgia, reliving those gnarly tunes, iconic movies, epic video games, and all the pop culture goodness that made growing up totally awesome. Major shout out and mondo thanks to my weekly co-host for another righteous trip down memory lane. Your stories and vibes made this retro journey even more bodacious. Want to keep the party going? Hit us up on social media. We're talking Facebook, Instagram, maybe even a little MySpace just for the LOLs. And don't forget to cruise over to tubulartimemachine.com where you can catch past episodes, send us your memories, or suggest a year you want us to fire up in the flux capacitor for next time. And hey, if you're digging the ride and want to help us keep this retro machine rolling, head over to buymeacoffee.com/Mr. Raz. Your support helps fuel future episodes and keeps the good vibes alive. Until next time, keep your mixtapes fresh, your VHS rewound, and your vibes totally tubular. Catch you on the flip side, dude and dudettes.
Hey there, dude and dudettes. It's time to rewind from neon nights to that vintage vibe. Mixtapes, arcades, butterfly clips. We're cruising the past with totally rad tips. Break it up. Past is always rad.